She might have gone on, but about then the main doors to the front hall opened again, and this time it was Liza. She was alone, dressed in the same modified fencer's costume she'd worn for her duel with Utina, and carrying the same swept-hilt rapier. Without an administrative audience to play to, she came in without her usual air of smooth command. Instead, she positively radiated hostility as she stepped past Amanda, who put away her stylus and loop, and sat weighing her gladius judiciously, as though considering throwing it, into the middle of the room and swept her blue eyes across the assemblage. "I might have known you'd be behind this, Katie, dear," she said. "Where did you get this one?" Liza looked Jury up and down with cool deliberation, taking in her unfamiliar martial uniform and the hardness of her expression. "Hmph," she added. "You do seem to surround yourself with the most unfeminine creatures. Anyway, what do you want? I won't admit to anything, and you'll never prove it. You can't make me do anything." "Then why did you come?" asked Jury, stepping in front of Liza and blocking her line of sight to Kate. "I wanted to be certain that Katie here was responsible for this latest outrage," Liza replied. Tilting her head inquisitively, she went on, "Does she pay you in money or service?" Most of the assembled group went tense, well, tenser, at that. Amanda seemed almost ready to get up, until Devlin, who was still sitting there next to her with that deceptively sleepy look on his face, put his hand on her arm and shook his head slightly, no. Kate folded her arms and looked annoyed. "I don't fight for money," Jury said, "and I don't need service. This doesn't have anything to do with Caitlin or her society. I don't know or care anything about your little campus politics. This is personal." Liza blinked at her, genuinely lost. "I don't follow you." "You need to learn that attacking people who've never done you any harm isn't as safe as you seem to think," said Jury. Liza snorted. "Oh, that's rich. Which of us assaulted the other this afternoon? I've never seen you before in my life." Then a sly smile stole over her face. "Oh, I get it. This is about poor little Mr. Kaworu, isn't it? The boy genius can't hack the pressure here at the Institute, so you're looking for someone to blame. Well, why doesn't he stand up for himself, then? If he's convinced that I had something to do with his unfortunate mishap, why doesn't he confront me about it himself, instead of hiding behind you?" Jury smiled. It wasn't a nice smile. "If he touched you," she replied, "he might get dirty, and I prefer him clean." Mickey, who still sat where he'd been while Ezzelin ministered to his stress level, went a bit red. Liza went a good deal redder, if not for the same reason. "You'll pay for that," she promised Jury. "I'll make sure of that." "We'll see," replied Jury coolly. "If you're finished with the preliminary posturing," said Dorothy blandly, "perhaps we can get started." Liza looked annoyed, Jury faintly amused, as the robot girl fitted each of them with a rose hurriedly acquired from the Institute florist shop down on Highland Street. Liza got another yellow rose. The shop hadn't had any orange ones, so Jury had to make do with red. Mickey, as club secretary, had been half-jokingly tasked with finding some place that carried all the strange colors that might be required for proper assignment during the society's impromptu tournament. This was done half-jokingly because, with this illegal duel looming and Utina still missing at the time, no one had it in them to make more than half a joke. The duelists gathered in front of the stage to watch and stay out of the way. Azalin glanced to her right as Sayanji jumped down from the stage to lean against the front of the proscenium, arms folded. He looked immensely but privately amused by something. "What's so funny?" she whispered. "This," Sayanji replied. "Broadbank has no idea what she's in for. Arisugawa was the best of us. Better than Tenjo." So why didn't she win? Azalin wondered. It wasn't her destiny, said Sionji, nor the Rose Bride's. Azalin looked faintly puzzled by that, but let it go, because it wouldn't do to be having a philosophical debate during somebody else's duel. Liza and Juri stood facing each other across the width of Alden's main hall. Alden Memorial was a rather odd building. Though built from the start as the Institute's Center for the Performing Arts, its exterior and the look and layout of its main hall gave it the odd impression that it was really a converted church, with its high, narrow windows, polished wood, rear balcony with organ, and overall sense of quiet solemnity. It merely lacked pews and had a theater stage instead of an altar. That atmosphere, thought Skaya, was quite appropriate for the conflict now taking place within it, a retelling in miniature of the ancient, eternal, and irresolvable clash between righteousness and wickedness, that grandest and oldest of tales. It suited both the ecclesiastical and the theatrical airs of the place to have this battle take place within its walls. As he stood against the corner of the stage and observed, the Skrang thought maybe he felt another painting coming on. Corwin Ravenhair pulled his antique griffin into a parking space in front of the wedge, humming a little tune, then shut the car down and climbed out with Nall, as ever, on his shoulder. For a moment, he stood next to the car, hands in the pockets of his overcoat, smiling around at the snow-covered quad. Then he thumbed the auto-lock button on the car's remote control, waited until the armored shields had sealed, turned, and walked off past Riley Hall and down the hill to Galaxy House. Nobody seemed to be at home, or at least nobody was answering the door. That struck Corwin as a little bit odd, but he supposed he should have expected something like it might happen. "I told you we should have called ahead," Nall grumbled as they walked back up the hill to the wedge. "Relax, Nall. Somebody'll be around." As they explored the usual haunts a bit more, though, Corwin started to wonder. There was no one of note in the wedge. No one answered his knock at Morgan 412's door. "Hmm," he mused, standing in the Morgan 4th hallway. "This is kind of a bummer. I wonder where everybody is." "Maybe they're having a rehearsal or something," Nall suggested. "On Friday?" Corwin wondered. Then he shrugged. "I guess it wouldn't hurt to go see." The side door of Alden Memorial was open, so Corwin, familiar with the place from previous visits, just went right on in. Once inside, he could hear the clash of steel coming from the main hall. This was curious for a Friday, but not surprising in itself, so he didn't put on much haste as he headed in that direction. The vista that came to his eyes when he opened the side doors and went into the hall itself, however, held enough surprises to keep him standing there looking for a couple of minutes. The whole Duelist Society, and several others, were gathered there, watching a fight between a pair of combatants Corwin didn't immediately recognize. Wait. Okay, the blonde was Liza Broadbitch, that was kind of odd, but whatever. The redhead, though, he was certain he'd never seen before. She was of a type he was familiar with. Tall, a bit regal, a bit scary. When your mother is captain of the Valkyrie, you get used to tall, regal, scary women in a hurry. The next thing that became obvious was that this was no duel for fun. Both women's faces were hard and cold, their eyes furious, and sparks flew from their clashing blades. Rose duel or not, this was for keeps. Some offense was being redressed here. Given that one of the players was Liza, Corwin supposed that wasn't all that surprising. "The redhead's good," Nall murmured. "Hmm," said Corwin. He didn't care much for swordplay himself, the doing of it anyway. He could easily be convinced to watch it. But he'd been trained in it pretty extensively all the same. He could recognize skill and talent when he saw it, and the redhead had plenty of both. She moved like a fencer, with quick lunges and a very fast hand, but there was a fluidity to her motions that was usually absent from formal fencing. The blade she wielded was a straight saber with a double-ring hilt, not a fencer's saber, but a live weapon, edged and bearing a wicked point. It was a little shorter than Liza's rapier, but the redhead's reach was a little longer, so it all evened out. Corwin took a moment to scan the assembled audience for this duel and found some more surprises there. Utna looked like she'd received some very bad news. She was a little pale and sad-looking, and stood quietly, watching the fight without much animation. She held Tiny Robo against her chest in crossed arms, her chin resting on top of his turret head. And Corwin's aunt Belle was standing behind her, hands on her shoulders. What the... The rest of the group looked tense and angry. Kate was practically livid, and there was a dark-haired girl there Corwin had never seen before. Desperately curious as to what had happened, both to Utna and to the group in general, Corwin squelched his questions and joined the crowd as unobtrusively as possible. Kate noticed him, gave him a surprised glance and a tight little smile, and returned her attention to the fight. Utna's glance was a little less surprised, her smile, if wan, rather warmer. Corwin was glad of that, at least, and returned it, feeling his face get a bit warm, before he went back to paying attention to the duel as well. "Is this the best you have to offer?" Jury inquired coolly as she beat back Liza's attempt at offense and pressed her back. "I'm told you're the captain of the school's fencing club. If you represent the Institute's best, I must say that's rather sad." Liza made no reply. She was too busy parrying, then having her counter-thrust preempted by Jury's superior speed. "Even in this non-standard format," Jury went on, "I can see the flaws in your technique. At Otori Academy, you would be disqualified from competition." "I've been hearing a lot about this Otori Academy lately," Liza sneered, giving her attack new strength with a flurry of feints and harassing lunges. "How is it that I've never heard of it before? They say it was on the Outer Rim, but my family's heard of all the good schools, even out there." Jury crossed her up, breaking the flow of her attack, and replied, "The Academy didn't need to advertise. Its students are drawn to it by destiny, not marketing." Liza snorted, her composure visibly fracturing. "Destiny? What a crock! Next you'll tell me you believe in miracles and Santa Claus." Jury cracked a tiny smile and replied sardonically, "Santa Claus, no. Miracles..." She trapped Liza's next thrust, twisted, and flung the rapier from the blonde's hand. Liza stumbled back, her face blank with shock, and fell to the floor. Jury stood over her, leveling her blade, and went on, "Miracles I'm still out on." It wouldn't occur to Miki, Sayanji, or Utna for several hours that Jury had just made a pun on her own name. Liza's rapier hit Apogee, turned, and fell, point down, in a remarkably dangerous fashion. Utna had a sudden feeling of déjà vu. Jury just smiled a little wider and a little nastier, took one smooth, unconcerned step to the side, and let it whang vertically into the floor and stand there wobbling while she flicked Liza's rose easily from the breast of her tunic. Liza stared up at her, all her arrogance, anger, and everything else wiped away by the sheer surprise of that calm and casual avoidance of peril. The redhead hadn't even looked. It was like she'd known that would happen. "I never fall for the same trick twice," Jury told her coolly, "even if it's fates." Liza collected her sword and her damaged dignity, and left the field without further comment, having been coldly instructed by Jury to return Miki's notebook within 6 hours or suffer the, unspecified but implied by the redhead's icy green eyes, consequences. Beldandy fussed about the damage to the hall's hardwood floor, then repaired it with a gesture and a few curious words, which took the assembled company somewhat by surprise, though they were too polite to go asking a lot of awkward questions. Mia was introduced to the rest of the duelists, Corwin and Nall. She took Nall's claim of dragonhood with smiling equanimity and a deep and formal bow, which pleased the little dragon to no end. The group then broke up, some of them going down the hill to celebrate Jury's victory at Galaxy House, while others begged off and pursued other ends. As they were leaving the hall, Megazone appeared from behind the big beech tree standing on an island in the middle of the driveway, that led from West Street to the parking lot in front of Sanford Riley Hall, and beckoned to Utina. They conferred for a few moments, too quietly to be heard by the rest of the group. Then Utina turned and called to Jury. "This is Megazone," she said as Jury approached. "He's the one who helped me get established when I first came here." "I'd like to talk to you privately for a few minutes," Zoner told Jury. "It won't take long." Jury gave him a skeptical-looking once-over, decided there was no reason to be too wary of him, and nodded. "Fine," she turned to Utina. "I'll catch up." "Okay," said Utina. Turning to Megazone, she went on, "Zoner, thanks. Again, I owe you." Zoner made a dismissive gesture. "It's my job." "Well, thanks anyway," said Utina with a grin that showed her fast recovering strength. She paused for a second, as if not quite sure what to do, then settled for patting him on the arm and trotting off after the others. They got nearly halfway across the front of Riley Hall before Azalin turned around and yelled, "Zoner!" "What?" Zoner bellowed back. "Will I see you at Terzale this year?" Zoner frowned thoughtfully. "What day is that?" Azalin did a bit of mental calculation. "Next Saturday, the 19th. Zoner considered for a second, then yelled, "Sure!" "Great!" yelled Azalin. "I'll make extra pudding. See ya!" "Bye!" Zoner shouted, and the group moved off, chattering happily. Zoner turned and walked off toward Boynton Hall, gesturing for Jury to follow him. "What do you want to talk to me about?" Jury asked him flatly. "Well," said Zoner, "I need to know a couple of things about you before I can get your paperwork done. You know, little things like your date of birth." "On your calendar, December 1st, 2387, she replied. Zoner cocked an eyebrow and smiled at her as they crossed the footbridge. "You'd already figured that out." "Dorothy and I worked out a conversion. It's really very simple. Our calendar is essentially the same as yours. The names of the months are different, but their places are the same. It's a very curious coincidence," Jury went on, in a tone of voice that made it clear she didn't think it was a coincidence at all, "that we even have the same very short month that gets one day longer every 4 years." "Yeah, how about that?" Zoner replied nonchalantly. "Okay, so you're 17. You must have been, what, a junior?" Jury nodded, then asked with a tone of faint amusement, "Shouldn't I be giving this information to some legitimate authority?" "Oh, but I am a legitimate authority," said Zoner airily. He paused on the pathway down the hill behind Boynton and turned to face her, suddenly holding a camera. "Say Australopithecus," he said, leveling it. Jury gave him a puzzled look. "What?" "Good enough," said Zoner. "Flash!" "Anyway," he went on as he jacked the camera into a cable that led into one of his coat pockets, "I know a legitimate authority. I'm on the phone with him right now. Friend of mine who runs a very nice, very liberal little space republic. Caitlin's father, as a matter of fact. He's been kind enough to provide citizenship, with all the fun benefits that brings with it, to Utina and Miki as well." "And Sionji?" "Well, sort of retroactively, him too, yeah," said Zoner, looking a little distracted. "Excuse me a second, sending a fax." Jury regarded him with an expression somewhere between disbelief and amusement. Somewhere inside his coat, something went whir, click, beep, and an item fell out of his sleeve into his hand. He turned and presented it to her with a flourish. It was an identification card in her name, featuring a small, slightly grainy hollow of her quizzical face. Something else chimed. He reached into a pocket and pulled out a passport. Several other documents came from various other openings in the coat, and Zoner collated them and handed them all over. "These are all legitimate," said he, handing over the passport and a couple of other documents bearing the Great Seal of the Republic of Zeta Cygni. "This is a forgery," he went on, handing over a card bearing the sigil of the Psi Corps, "but it's a very good one. You're not telepathic by any chance, are you? As far as I know, no, Jury replied. Well, let's try a little experiment. What am I thinking? A pause. Okay, you didn't hit me. You're not telepathic. Good, good. That can be problematic nowadays. Well, I think that's everything. I have to be getting back. Wait a second. Why are you doing this? What do you expect to gain? Zoner gave her a curious look and replied, Not everything has to be done for gain. Maybe I just like helping. He smiled. Besides, anybody who makes it their business to seek out Liza Broadbank and belt her one first thing upon arriving in a strange new world has earned my help. You're the perfect person to take her down a few pegs, too. You're better at everything she does. Jury snorted. Some achievement. Anyway, I'm certainly not better at being rich. Oh, we can fix that, said Zoner. He took back the red WDF credit union card, slid it into a slot on a small PDA-type device, made a few adjustments with a stylus, and handed the card back after it beeped, saying, There, now you're well endowed. There was a brief, awkward pause. Jury raised an eyebrow. You have a lot of money, said Zoner, his expression wooden. Just like that, said Jury dryly. Just like that, Zoner replied. Look, I've been around a long time, and I've made a lot of business deals. Quite a few of them I made so long ago I've forgotten about them, but they're still paying off, right? So I get these huge checks in the mail and can't even remember what the hell I did to earn them. It's a pain in the ass. So I just give it away. I think the trust fund I just set up for you is revenues from Scudco, but I could be wrong. He shrugged. Doesn't matter anyway. Spend in good health. Any idea what you're going to do with yourself, or is it too soon to think about that? Much too soon, Jury replied. For now, I'll go see if I can find Galaxy House. Oh, I know where that is, Zoner said airily. I'll walk you down, then I have to clear out. Things to do. I gotta see a lady about a magic midget. Jury gave him another odd look, then decided she didn't want to pursue it. Kate, Utna, Corwin, Dorothy, Moose, Miki, and Mia Ausa sat in the living room at Galaxy House, talking over the day's events. Beldandy, who accompanied them, had noted the kitchen upon entering the house, smiled, and said she would join them shortly. Skaya had excused himself and gone up to his room. The muse, apparently, was upon him, and he was off to capture his impressions in paint before the notion left him. The others thus retired to the living room, where they spent the first half hour or so, interrupted only by the arrival of Jury, filling Corwin in on the events of the past few days. Dorothy's travails with Professor Harris, the problem of Miki's notebook that had led to Liza's duel with Jury, and the day's excitement caused by a now quite sheepish Utna. She didn't elaborate on where she'd gone, only insisted that she was all right now, and very sorry for worrying everyone. Corwin didn't know which way to jump. Whether to be furious about the school's treatment of Dorothy, spend some time thinking unpleasant thoughts about Liza first, or skip right to being worried about Utna. While he was pondering that, Beldandy came in with a big plate of warm chocolate chip cookies. Nobody made chocolate chip cookies like Aunt Belle. Shortly thereafter, Mac McKenzie wandered down, drawn by the scent of food, and was introduced. Sorry I didn't let you in, Mac said to Corwin when he found out Kate's brother had been ringing the doorbell earlier. I sort of passed out on my pre-calc book. Corwin nodded. Math'll do that to a person. No big problem. I'm also sorry to hear about what's happened to you, Dorothy, he added. I've written a letter to Residential Life expressing my concerns with your treatment. Thank you, said Dorothy. That was very kind. But I've found a place to live again. Everything should work out in the end. Mac smiled a little. I know Jacron would like to work something out on Professor Harris's end, he said. Good thing for the professor that he's a pacifist. Well, I'm not, Corwin growled. I'm tempted to go find that guy tomorrow and give him what for. That would hardly improve my situation, Dorothy observed. No, I suppose not, Corwin admitted, sighing heavily. Then he cracked a wry grin, looked from Dorothy to Utna, and said, "I don't come around for a couple weeks, and you go all to pieces on me." Utna grinned a little shyly and said, "Well, yeah. How am I supposed to keep it together for 2 whole weeks without Nall?" Nall said, "Ha!" Then he jumped across the room to her seat, curled up in her lap, and gave Corwin a smug look while she scratched his ears. Corwin just shrugged with a sort of, "Well, I missed the bus on that one, didn't I?" look on his face. Mac bade the gathering a good night then, and went back to his room to complete the homework that had been interrupted by his nap, then get some sleep. A real party animal, that was Mac McKenzie. The rest endeavored to keep their voices down. Liza Broadbank locked up her desk in the student council offices on the ground floor of Daniels Hall, then left the office and locked it behind her. Feeling curiously furtive, she stole down the central corridor and left the building by the door next to the campus bookstore, passing the automatic teller machine and descending the steps to the quad. She paused for a second at the parking spaces to wonder whose antique limousine was parked there, then recalled her mission and struck off across the deserted quad. She was seething with rage and disdain for those duelist society ruffians. How dare they bring in a ringer to trounce her like that? She didn't know who that woman thought she was. In fact, Liza had never learned her name. But if she thought that their pointless duel changed anything, the nameless redhead with the smug little smile had another think coming, by God. She'd have to learn, just like all the rest, that you didn't push Liza Broadbank around that way. The notebook they were all so keen to recover was tucked under her arm. It had been locked in the bottom drawer of her desk in the council offices since one of her sycophants had pilfered it from Kaworu's bag in Galactic History 203. Now it was going on a little trip, but it wasn't going down to Galaxy House to be handed over in ignominious defeat to that blue-haired little creep. No, sir. Mr. Miki Kaworu was going to learn a lesson about messing with the family Broadbank. There was a hazardous waste disintegrator in the basement of Olin Hall, and that would do very nicely indeed. As she crossed from the quad to the faculty parking lot between Riley Hall and the alumni gym, it suddenly struck Liza how creepy the campus was at night. It was especially so right now, for some reason. The usually bustling campus was quiet, eerily quiet. Normally at this hour, not even 10 yet, on a Friday, one could hear music from the dorms, and people would be walking here and there, crossing the campus on various errands and missions. But right now it was silent, but for the winter breeze, and there was no one here but Liza. She held the notebook a little tighter under her arm, chided herself for being foolish, and went into the alley between Alumni Gym and the back of Higgins Labs. This was normally lit by a flood lamp on the back of the lab building, but Liza realized as she entered the alley that it was out. She paused, almost quailing, and then shook her head angrily. This was stupid. What was she afraid of? It was a 10-foot walk from one side to the other, around the back of Higgins and down West Street to Olin. Nothing. 30 seconds worth of a fast walk. There was nothing in there that was going to bother her. Liza was most of the way through the alley when she heard the noise, low and guttural, like the growl of some large, violently disposed animal. She froze, the hairs on the back of her neck standing up, and looked wide-eyed into the darkness around her. Ahead, under the shadow of the Higgins Lab's fire escape, a shadowy shape moved. A pair of eyes glittered golden from the darkness, and then the shape moved into the beam of moonlight slanting down between the trees behind Olin Hall and was revealed. As Alin Devere Natashkin stood between Liza and West Street, her hands on her hips, the Dantrovian's normally sunny face was set in a grim scowl, the moonlight doing interesting things to the shading of her coppery skin, silver hair, and golden eyes. "You're going the wrong way, Liza," said Azalin in a soft, menacing voice, so utterly unlike her normal cheery chirp that it was nearly unrecognizable. She raised her hand and pointed southward, back the way Liza had come. at the end of her finger, protruding from underneath the fingernail, an inch-long, wickedly curved and pointed claw gleamed silvery black in the moonlight. "Galaxy House is that way," Azalyn continued. Liza took a half-step back. "I'm not afraid of you," she said haughtily. You rodent." Gathering her rattled composure, she whirled, and then recoiled with a little shriek as she nearly plowed head-on into a tall, slim, black silhouette with softly glowing scarlet eyes. Amanda Dessler's hand flashed out and snatched the notebook from Liza's shock-slackened grip. Her teeth shone whitely against the blackness of her silhouetted outline as she said with cold contempt, "Then you're an even bigger fool than I took you for, human." Her piece said, Amanda turned on her heel and took a step away. Liza, torn between rage and panic, grabbed at the padded shoulder of the Gamelon's black leather cycling jacket. With the faintest sound of breath through teeth, Amanda whirled and seized Liza's hand in her own. The next thing Liza Broadbank knew, she was kneeling on the cold, icy pavement of the alley, her arm awkwardly twisted, Amanda's thumb pressing agonizingly down on the nerve cluster in the center of her palm. A strangled sound of pain forced its way out from between Liza's anguish-whitened lips. "Go ahead, human," Amanda hissed, lowering her face so that it was right in Liza's. "Push me that one final inch. No one will ever know what happened to you." Liza made one last attempt to get back her usual mien, muttering, "I might have known. Wherever one of you goes in the night, the other's certain to be within arm's reach." Amanda cocked her lips into a cold smile. She chuckled ever so slightly. "Compelling image, isn't it?" she asked. Then she released the blonde's hand, spun once more, and strode away, vanishing into the dark. Liza knelt there, shivering and trying to rub some life into her hand for a couple of seconds, then froze again, her eyes going wide, as something cool and extremely sharp-feeling touched the side of her neck. Slowly, almost lovingly, Azalyn drew her unsheathed index claw around under the line of Liza's jaw, tracing the curve of her slender throat with an exquisitely delicate touch before drawing it up underneath her jaw to rest at the point of her chin. The Dantrovian's face was right next to Liza's, her gold eyes shining eerily in the night. "You're so lovely," Azalyn whispered softly, her breath warm and sweet against Liza's cheek. Then she cupped the blonde's throat in her whole hand, thumb and three fingers leaving four little burning spots where the tip of each claw pressed against the flesh, and went on in an even softer, more intimate tone. "It's such a shame your soul is empty." Then, as though she had never been there at all, she was gone. Liza knelt there on the icy ground for several minutes, trembling, her heart pounding, before she was finally able to pull herself together, get to her feet, and stumble off past the library and down the hill to Founders Hall. No one would ever believe her if she reported this, and she knew she would never be able to anyway. This time, she was beaten.